Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning. We're delighted to welcome with us today several groups. First, we have Franklin High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Cedarburg High School. Would you please stand? We're delighted to see you as Hayden and I. We're especially delighted to see you again, having attended the Teaching Institute. Thank you. Thank you for coming and bringing your class. You may be seated. The students are here with us this morning with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students across the state are invited to join us for a oral argument, and if the class agrees to come, the class gets briefs, and they may engage in outside activities relating to the case. When they come, they listen to oral argument and meet with a justice at the end of the second oral argument, that is approximately at noon. Everyone is invited to attend that session. The discussion will be about the procedures used in the court, not the substantive issues that are presented in these cases. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, please raise your hand and the marshal will bring it to you. All right? Good. It's easier to listen and understand it if you're familiar with the facts and issues as presented. And that's done by Amanda Todd and some of the lawyers on the staff as Mr. Knight is aware. I'd like to introduce the court to you all, starting on my far right. Is Justice Patience Rogensack. She's the justice with whom you'll meet at noon today. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Brooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and to her left is Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I will call the first case today, which is State versus Shirley E. Arguing on behalf of the Children's Court Center is Rebecca Ann Kiefer. And arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant State Public Defender. I'm sorry, I'm arguing on behalf of Shirley E. is Assistant State Public Defender Andrea Cornwall. Ms. Kiefer.
May it please support the court. Good morning. My name is Rebecca Kiefer, and I'm an assistant district attorney in Milwaukee County. I represent the people of the state of Wisconsin in this matter. This case is about a seven-year-old boy named Torrance P. He was born into this world cocaine positive. Shortly after his birth, he was taken by his biological mother and left in the care of his paternal grandparents in Alabama. He remained there until he was taken to Milwaukee by his biological father. He was detained from his biological father in April of 2002, and he was found to be in need of protection and services in November of 2002. Torrance was returned to his biological father in October of 2003 under an order of supervision. He remained there until December 19, 2003, when police responded to the home of his biological father. To a domestic violence disturbance, Shirley E. and the biological father were physically attacking one another in the process destroying their Christmas tree all of which incurred in front of Torrance P. As a result, both Shirley E. and Torrance P. were taken into custody. Shirley E. was taken into custody on an absconder warrant. She was in parole in the state of Michigan, and Torrance P. On the underlying domestic violence dispute. This was the last time that Torrance saw Shirley E. He has been in foster care since that time, and since April 2005, Torrance has been thriving in a home that very much wishes to adopt him. We are asking that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals in this matter, as it removes from the power of the trial court the ability to strike a parent's contest posture as a sanction for violating a trial court order. The opinion in Shirley E. elevates a parent's participation through counsel from a matter once within the sound discretion of the trial court to a constitutional requirement with no appropriate constitutional basis for doing so.
You don't think there's a constitutional right for a parent to have a lawyer?
Not in every case. The United States Supreme Court addressed this issue in Lassiter versus the Department of Social Services of Durham County, North Carolina. In that case, the United States Supreme Court found that a natural parent's right to court-appointed counsel should be determined by the trial court on a case-by-case basis.
So your position is if the attorney was not court-appointed but hired by Shirley E., what is your position? Could the judge throw her out?
In this case, yes, because Shirley E. had been found in default by the trial court. She was found in default on March 8, 2004 in the litigation for her failure to appear personally before the court, as ordered by the trial court.
So if there's a default, then the judge can throw out hired counsel or appointed, state-appointed counsel. Before an argument on the merits as to the grounds for termination and before the final disposition. Is that right? That's your position?
The evaluation of the test outlaid in Lassiter.
Is that your position?
I'm sorry, could you restate that question?
Yes. Before the court decides the grounds for termination. And before the court decides disposition, the judge can order counsel out of the court, whether it's privately retained counsel or public counsel.
If the parent has been found in default and is not participating in the matter.
That's right. And then the judge, after the default, then the judge finds grounds. And you think that's okay without counsel. That's my question.
Yes. Okay. And that is because a parent who has been defaulted at the grounds phase and does not appear to reopen that default loses their ability to contest the grounds phase.
Right.
Go ahead. Did the during the grounds phase, she was defaulted before the grounds phase. Is that correct?
Before the testimony was taken.
Let me just get this right. There were a number of hearings. My question would be, had the judge allowed her to stay in during the ground phase, would this be a different case? In other words, as I understand it, the attorney, Attorney Smith.
Correct.
Was not there, correct?
Correct.
She wanted to be there, but the judge apparently asked her, said, you're no longer needed here.
Correct. The judge asked her to leave,
now,
yes.
Now, had she been there during that, when the evidence was put on, would that have made a difference?
The outcome would be the same because Shirley E. was in default and was not able to put forth a defense or provide witnesses in her defense to contest the termination of parental rights petition since she had been defaulted as to the grounds phase. Now, if she had come to court or if her attorney had requested a hearing to reopen the default, it would be a completely different case than what we have now. But this case as it stands, that motion was never made. No reasonable reason why Shirley E. was missing court was ever proffered to the court, at least such that the trial court could have alleviated the problem for Shirley E. or made an exception for her to appear by phone.
Now, that was only speculated on because I believe the state said there was a warrant in Winnebago County, and Attorney Smith said that it was because of lack of funds, poverty, perhaps incarceration, but nobody really knew why she didn't come to court.
Incarceration was never proffered as a reason. Shirley E. was a parolee at that point in time in Michigan.
And could travel,
had permission to. The reason that her attorney proffered to the court at one court hearing, one of the many reasons, was that she may not have been given permission to travel. Incarceration was never something that was brought up. But yes, there was never any concrete relief that was asked of the trial court or of the Bureau of Milwaukee Child Welfare to allow Shirley E. to attend court hearings. And in this case, with the record before the court, we know that the Bureau was providing the biological father Greyhound bus tickets to come from Nina when he was unemployed so that he could attend both trial court hearings on the matter as well as visitation with his son.
Now, who was providing the tickets?
The Bureau of Milwaukee Child Welfare.
Was that offered to Shirley E.?
It was never requested by Shirley E. She had not been in contact with the Bureau of Milwaukee Child Welfare for quite some time.
Could I ask this question? Shirley E. was in Michigan with her mother at some point?
At the beginning of the case, it's unclear from the record. At one point in time, her attorney said that she had moved with her mother, but it's unclear exactly where she was residing.
My hypothetical question was, at the disposition stage of the proceeding, could Shirley E.'s mother have come in and made a statement or something of that sort?
Yes. By statute, any party can come before the court at the dispositional phase to provide testimony evidence to the court so that the court can consider that evidence. It's provided by statute. So, yes, she could.
Given what you just said, then why couldn't Shirley E.'s attorney do something at the dispositional stage?
Shirley E.'s attorney could have if Shirley E. came back and wanted to provide evidence. At the point in time that Shirley E.'s attorney was there, she wasn't providing any evidence to the court. She never provided the court with any basis for why she wasn't there, never provided the court with whether or not the mother wanted to contest the matter.
But a lawyer can aid a client by questioning witnesses, right?
That's true, but the premise of that is aiding the client. When the client isn't there to be aided, there is no need for the attorney. And when a parent chooses not to participate in these termination of parental rights matters, having counsel at the table...
Okay, then why didn't the judge say, you're in default? Now we're going to get to disposition. You are not here. You are in default. End of the case. I'm giving this child, I'm terminating parental rights.
Without hearing any testimony?
Yeah. What's the matter with that?
You have to have an evidentiary basis for...
Where does it say that?
Evelyn C.R. provides that even if a parent is found in default, there has to be evidence to support the termination of parental rights.
But what is the advantage of having an evidentiary hearing if you have prohibited either the mother or the mother's counsel from participating? It's a one-sided evidentiary hearing. How fair can that be?
Well, it's not exactly one-sided because there is an attorney present for the child. So there's the guardian ad litem.
That doesn't represent the mother.
That's correct.
The guardian ad litem does not represent the mother. So, and it's the mother's rights who are being terminated. The guardian ad litem represents the best interest, and the state is representing the child.
Yes, that's correct.
As I understand it.
So knowing now that the Evelyn case was out, I think, in 2001, the judge could have followed that procedure because that was the default. Of course, we found harmless error. But
correct.
Here you're maintaining that they don't even have to go that far, that it's a decisional responsibility of the mother or the father. In this case, it was the mother. She never appeared because that the court maintaining, let's say, the administrative oversight. This was a case that was frequently adjourned, that he would have, he balanced these things and then said that the attorney was no longer needed rather than following the procedure set up in the Evelyn case.
The trial judge told the attorney for Shirley E. that she could participate in the matter by filing a motion to vacate the default judgment.
Yes, he gave her that, but then he excused the attorney. So, in other words, the attorney wanted to stay, as I understand it. She said that she had an obligation, but that the judge said, no, you're no longer needed here. Or words to that effect.
Yeah, she said that she had an obligation to stay in touch with her client. And the judge said that since she didn't have a motion to vacate the default and hadn't asked the court for that and hadn't provided a reason for why Shirley wasn't there, that she could go.
But had she stayed, you wouldn't be here, right? I mean, there wouldn't be any question. The real question is whether or not the attorney has to, even though the client is not cooperative, is unresponsive, whatever you want to say, the real issue is here is whether or not the attorney should have been allowed to stay. Had the attorney stayed, would you be here?
I don't think I would be here, but I also don't think there would be any different outcome to the hearing because she wouldn't have been able to participate in the hearing.
The attorney wouldn't have been able to participate in the hearing? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
If I can follow up on that, you've stated as an issue in the case, the way you stated it, is whether a defaulted parent in termination of parental rights proceeding maintains a due process right to be represented following the default. Now, I look at the default sanctions portion of the statute, 804.12, and I see a number of different things that a trial court can do when a person is in default. I do not see as one of the sanctions removal of counsel. So my question to you is, under what authority can a trial court judge remove the attorney following the default when that's not listed as one of the sanctions under the statute?
I don't have any authority for why a trial court judge could throw another attorney out of court aside from general policies about a trial court judge maintaining their courtroom. However, the outcome in this case would not have been the same, would have been the same, strike that, if her attorney had been able to stay in the courtroom or if she hadn't, simply because she would not have been able to participate in the matter. It was a prove-up hearing.
Counsel, can I just raise that issue? Because that I would take that as a given, but we really don't know. What if, and I'm just, this is hypothetical, but it's also speculation on this case, what if the mother could not have come for whatever, what if she said, I just found out that this, she had an incurable disease, that whatever. See, that's what the attorney could have raised, as well as sitting there and making sure that the grounds that we all think could have been, I mean, this is really a sad case. It is a case where I think all of the justices understand the, let's say, the really problem with the young person here and how much he has suffered in the sense of not having any permanency in his life. But what I'm saying, this is just speculation when you say it would be the same, because there may have been some intervening thing which we don't know about. Like if the mother had some terminal illness and couldn't travel. Now, I'm not saying, but would that have made a difference?
I mean, that's not this case. There was never a reason given for why Shirley wasn't coming to court. And I understand.
I guess what I'm saying, that could have been this case. There wasn't, because we know that the person had very little, if any, contact with the lawyer. But I think Justice Butler is pointing out that the sanction that was used here was perhaps extreme in the sense that it's something where we understand that a judge runs his or her courtroom, but what was the harm in allowing the person to remain when they wanted to do it?
Thank you. I understand the question. And with the example of a parent who's unable to travel because they might be sick in the hospital, have some sort of mental state, not being incarcerated out of state and having not being able to travel for whatever reason, the trial court at this point in time has the discretion to allow their attorney to remain and excuse their participation, their personal appearance in court, until the jury trial. It's up to the trial court's discretion. In this case, there was never any reason, anything even remotely like that, proffered to the court so that the court could consider that, maybe take a default under advisement, maybe continue to allow Shirley E. to appear by phone, which I would note she did not contact the court and did not appear by phone after the February 14th
Ms. Kiefer, let me ask you about one of the points made in the Court of Appeals decision. The Court of Appeals decision indicates that if you've got a civil case and you've got a default judgment, oftentimes the attorney for the defaulting party is not only able to stay in the proceedings, but is able to participate in the proceedings. I was thinking about the years that I was on the trial bench where we'd have a summary judgment, a partial summary judgment, and we'd still have issues of damages. We'd have a default judgment. We'd still have issues of damages. I would allow the attorney to participate. So I'm troubled by what you're saying, that if the attorney had been allowed to stay, she couldn't participate. How do you get to that conclusion?
Well, with the support from the civil statutes and the the damages example that you just gave, the default is to the liability portion of that lawsuit. And the damages portion is separate, similar to the dispositional hearing for a termination of parental rights case.
But here you were going to have a determination made by the court, first of all, on grounds.
Correct.
But secondly, on whether or not termination was in the best interest of the child. Now, those seem to me to be every bit as important as the amount of damages to be awarded on a default or on a partial summary judgment. I'm not seeing the distinction.
It is a very important determination that needs to be made by the trial court, and it's unfortunate that Shirley E. did not come to court, did not call the court, and did not participate in the matter. But allowing her attorney to sit in court unaided by her her client to provide her with information and to guide the attorney's advocacy for her is really a moot point. There's an empty right. Having an attorney in court when there's no client to advocate for.
Well, let me, if I might, get into what I understand went on in this particular case. You've got the social worker on the stand, and one of the grounds is that there was not a substantial parental relationship.
Correct.
There's evidence being presented. The judge is saying things like, gee, this isn't enough for me. You better put on more than what you're putting on, because if indeed the woman, her, not husband obviously, but the father of the child and the child were living together for a substantial period of time, how can I find there was never a substantial parental relationship? Isn't that something where the attorney for the mother could have developed the record one way or the other?
Yes, she could have if she had her client's participation and assistance.
Well, couldn't she just cross-examine the social worker who was presenting that information and perhaps have some real influence on whether or not the judge would find that that was a legitimate ground? My understanding is he found it was.
He did, after the state provided further information about the living conditions that Torrance P. was subjected to when he was living with living in the home of his biological father mostly, but when Shirley E. was residing there as well. There was constant domestic violence and likely drug abuse going on in the home.
Could I ask, may a parent waive the right to counsel?
A parent may waive the right to counsel, absolutely. By statute, it's provided.
If more than 18.
Correct, yes. A minor cannot, but an adult can.
Done here?
By her conduct, one could infer a waiver of counsel and waiver of desire to contest the petition. But waiver is really, I think, not the issue when default is. She was defaulted. She lost her ability to contest the matter by herself or through her counsel. So whether or not she waived her right to counsel is somewhat irrelevant, but it can be inferred from her conduct.
But doesn't it have to be on the record, waiver? I don't want counsel. You're indicating that just by not showing up, that's a waiver of counsel?
How can they waive on the record if they don't show up?
Excuse me. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Justice President.
I'm sorry?
How could someone waive on the record if they don't show up?
They cannot waive it on the record if they don't show up, but it can be waived by their actions implicitly, and State v. Coleman stands for that purpose, that a litigant can, through their their behavior in the trial court, frustrate their right to counsel.
Well, isn't Coleman a relate to a constitutional right to counsel provided to a criminal defendant?
Yes.
Isn't that different?
It is absolutely different. The constitutional protections provided to individuals that are facing criminal matters are much higher than they are for parents that are facing termination of parental rights lawsuits.
Counsel?
It's a civil matter, and there are due process rights afforded to parents, but it does not reach the level that of due process protections that are provided to criminal defendants.
I want to get the time frame straight here with regard to the default judgment. First of all, as I understand it, the court entered a default judgment against the mother before any testimony was taken on grounds. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that's contrary to Tequila or Evelyn. Is that correct?
Evelyn said that that was harmless error to do that.
It said it was error. Is that correct?
That is correct, Justice.
Okay. So the court erred by entering a default judgment without taking the evidence on the grounds. That was one of the holdings of Evelyn. Was that right?
That's correct,
okay.
Yes.
Now, there was a hearing, something scheduled in December, and there was something scheduled, an initial appearance, I think, that was scheduled in February and then in March. What happened in the December initial appearance?
At the December initial appearance, the biological father appeared. The biological mother failed to appear. The state did not ask for default because we did not have all of our notice returns yet. And that was filed with the court on February 14th, 2005.
So you didn't know whether or not everyone had been served. The father was there. You knew he had been served.
Exactly.
Well, he had noticed whether he'd been served or not. So because of that, then, the court wasn't able to proceed and scheduled the matter for February 14th. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then the mother appeared by phone. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then that's when the judge ordered, you have to appear at the next hearing.
In person.
In person. And that next hearing was March 8th.
That's correct.
And on March 8th, that's when he entered the default.
Exactly.
And what was, in order to enter a default, a sanction of default, you have to have egregious conduct. What was the egregious conduct that the court found? He had ordered her in February 14th, when she was there, to show up on March 8th, and she didn't. And what was the egregious conduct that he said was the basis of the default?
Her failure to appear. Her failure to personally appear or contact the court.
He didn't make any finding regarding why she was not there, though, did he?
The court did note that Shirley E. had an active warrant for her arrest, but made no specific findings as to why, because we couldn't know why she wasn't there.
But the court, in fact, the Court of Appeals, in a footnote, if I recall, indicates the court made no finding as to why she was not there.
It would be impossible to know unless she was available.
Well, by that time, there were already ideas floating around. One was the warrant. Another one was she didn't have money to get here. That's what her attorney had suggested. And I think maybe there was one other idea that was a possibility, and I can't remember what that was. But anyway, the court, how can you find the conduct egregious if you don't know what was going on?
She failed to personally appear in a matter that involved her biological child.
So is this case to stand for the proposition that if you fail to appear, it wasn't a default that was entered after many failures to appear. There wasn't notice of service at that first one in December, so you couldn't go forward. So she appeared then in February,
right,
ordered and didn't show, and the default was entered then. There was no pattern at that time of egregious behavior, was there?
No, but the pattern followed.
Yeah, but when the default was entered, it was that non-appearance.
Correct.
Could you repeat for me, when was the last time that the mother saw her child?
The last time the mother saw her child was when she was being arrested on December 19th, 2003, when she was being detained due to that domestic violence dispute between herself and the biological father of the child. Torrance has not seen his mother since that time.
What is the evidence in the record that Shirley E. wants to continue to be the parent of this child?
There is no evidence in the record of that, Justice. In fact, Shirley E. was advised by the trial court that if she didn't appear in person after the February 14th date, her rights would be automatically terminated. She said she understood that, and she didn't contact the court. She didn't write the court a letter, and she didn't have her attorney ask the court to reopen the default judgment. I would submit that by her conduct, she has told the court that she would like to have her rights terminated. A lot of times, parents choose not to come to court after they're advised by the trial court that their rights will be automatically terminated as a way of doing a voluntary. Sometimes parents vote with their feet in these cases. A voluntary termination of one's parental rights is a very gut-wrenching, heart-wrenching hearing to go through. It's a very hard thing for a parent to do. And when that parent who might want that result hears that all they have to do is just not come to court and that result will occur, sometimes parents choose to do that.
Well, she might be viewed as having a peculiar way of doing it since she's now going through two appeals, objecting to termination. I mean, I hear what you say, but
The state has no way of knowing, and there's nothing in the record as to what Shirley E. wishes at all. Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Ms. Kiefer.
Thank you.
Public Defender Andrea Taylor Cornwell, representing Shirley E.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Good morning, members of the court. My name is Andrea Taylor Cornwall, and I represent Shirley E., who's the mother of Torrance P. Jr. First, I'd like to address something that Ms. Kiefer suggested to the court. There is, in fact, evidence, and I do wish the court to take notice of this. Shirley E. did, in fact, wish to contest the termination of her rights, and there is, in fact, evidence of that in the record. And I refer the court to the transcript of the hearing on March 8th, when Shirley E.'s lawyer came into court and told the court that given her discussions with Shirley E., she fully anticipated, I'm quoting at page 4, lines 8 through 12, I fully anticipated, based on my conversations with Shirley E., that she would be asking me to enter a contest posture on her behalf and that we would be proceeding to litigate this matter. So I think it's clear.
So then what happens, though, is it?
Excuse me.
That isn't evidence, isn't it? That's just an opinion.
I think it's an indication based on her lawyer telling the court based on her discussions.
Is there a single recorded statement or document in this record that Shirley E. wants to continue to be the parent of this child?
A document in the record?
Yeah. Any letters?
There's nothing in the circuit court record that indicates that she entered a formal contest posture. But again, I would submit that her attorney, as an officer of the court, represented to the court that she had discussions with Shirley E. and that she did, in fact, wish to contest the matter.
Why was there never a motion to reopen the default judgment?
I don't know why there wasn't a formal motion to vacate the default judgment. I think in part it may have been because Shirley E. was not able to personally travel from Michigan to Wisconsin.
Why didn't the public defender try to get a bus ticket from the Bureau of Child Welfare as the father had?
I don't know why she did not ask for a bus ticket, and I don't know that that was exclusively the problem with the transportation. There was the issue of Shirley E.'s parole, and her lawyer did mention that to the court on at least one occasion and indicated that she had contacted Shirley E.'s parole agent and was attempting to find out whether she, in fact, had permission to travel from Michigan, because according to the Department of Correction directives, and I believe the state put this in their appendix in its brief, Shirley E. would have had to get permission from at least three Department of Corrections employees, staff members, in order to travel to Wisconsin for this hearing. So she simply couldn't just up and come to Wisconsin. She would have had to get permission.
That would have been grounds to reopen the default judgment, wouldn't it, if she was legally unable to come to Wisconsin?
It may have been, yes. It may have been grounds. But I don't know specifically.
Was counsel for Shirley E. ineffective in failing to get a bus ticket or failing to reopen these things or failing to provide any evidence?
I did not bring this on an ineffectiveness grounds, but in terms of providing any evidence, Justice, are you speaking of evidence of why she did not, why she failed to appear in court?
From what you tell this court, there isn't a shred of documentary evidence that this mother wants to continue being the mother. The procedural rights, I mean, she didn't show up. There is an explanation why she didn't show up. The opportunity to get a ticket wasn't utilized. No evidence that she was legally prevented from coming to Wisconsin has been provided. Isn't that ineffective assistance of counsel for Shirley E.?
Without having more factual basis for that, Your Honor, I cannot address whether, in fact, it would be ineffectiveness. Again, I did not bring that as a claim in this particular case. As far as the bus ticket, I know that the state suggested that she perhaps could have gotten a bus ticket through the Bureau. I'm not so sure that that's true. The father was provided with bus tickets prior to the termination action being filed. That was during the CHIPS proceeding, I believe. He was provided with bus tickets from Nina. But there's no indication that one was ever offered or it was suggested that a bus ticket would be paid for. And the court was advised by Shirley E.'s counsel that there were issues with poverty. And it was never suggested during those proceedings that, well, perhaps the court could provide or the Bureau could provide. They never offered to provide. It was never indicated that that was, in fact, an option. And I can certainly tell the court that in any cases that I've handled, I've never seen that as an option where a parent facing termination is offered by the Bureau a bus ticket or transportation to come from out of state to a hearing. So
also, it seems to me this is a case of, it's really a sad case.
It is a sad case.
Because, but what troubles me here, we have the rights, you're asserting the rights of your client, which we in this court take very seriously. There's also the question of, quote, the responsibilities, the responsibility of a mother who has a fundamental right, who seemingly can't even get a phone call from Michigan to Wisconsin to her counsel. This lasts for several years. What do you think? We have the case of Evelyn C.R., and it's argued by the state that that differs from this case. But had, for example, the court followed the Evelyn sequence, left counsel in, you wouldn't be here today, right?
If counsel had been allowed to participate, I don't expect that we would be here today. But I'm not so sure that had counsel been able to participate that the court would have, in fact, found grounds and would have terminated, because I think that the outcome may well have been different.
Well, on what basis? I mean, here is someone that hasn't seen the child for several years. The child is involved in this Christmas ornament argument, is taken away, no contact by the parent, now has found a stable home. That's the sad part of this. The sad part is that the best interests of the child, which should be paramount, are going to be subjected to the, quote, rights which have not been taken advantage of, and now it's the child's seven and a half years old, I believe.
Absolutely, and I understand the court's concern, but the
but more frustration with a with a system that allows this to happen.
I don't think depriving the parent of their right to counsel furthers.
Well,
I'm sorry.
I guess the only question, you know, we understand there you could have waived. Your opposing counsel says, well, this is waiver by not showing up. The problem is there is no, well, I don't know of any such waiver that exists. But it really troubles me that that we're struggling with this. We did have case law out there, at least, which perhaps fall in your favor. But the ultimate tragedy here is the young man who's sitting there in a stable environment now.
I understand the court's concern, but I think that depriving a parent of their right to counsel does not further. I think that in many cases it can delay permanence. And I understand we're talking about this specific case, but we're also talking about the procedure that the courts are going to need to follow in future termination cases. And I think for several reasons, stripping a parent of their right to counsel does not further permanence for the child. We're talking about the potential for further litigation. If the court, I think that the risk that the court may make an erroneous decision is increased by removing the parent's adversary counsel from the courtroom, and increasing the risk of error only increases the potential for challenges to the termination and potential disruption down the road of an adoption, and that certainly isn't good for the children.
Counsel, my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that your claim of a violation of right to counsel is based both on a constitutional argument and on a statutory argument. Let's start with the constitutional argument. Under Lassiter and the balancing test, why do you think there is a violation of the right to counsel?
For several reasons. First of all, Lassiter involved the appointment of counsel, okay, where there is no statutory right. Here we clearly have a statutory right that's been given by the legislature to counsel. And in Lassiter, the court merely said that constitutionally, due process did not require appointment in every case, that it's a case-by-case basis. But I think here, where the legislature has given the statutory right, where counsel, in fact, has been appointed, I think that there is a due process right, particularly when the parent has not appeared in court. It's important to protect the fundamental fairness of the hearings by ensuring that their position is advocated for. In Lassiter, Mrs. Lassiter was actually in court. The question was whether she should have a lawyer helping her. Mrs. Lassiter was able to cross-examine the social worker. She was able to testify on her own behalf. She was able to put on her own witness, her mother. So the question was whether the constitutionally due process required the assistance of counsel. Here, we not only have Shirley E. absent from the courtroom, admittedly, but we're removing her lawyer. You have no one to advocate on the parent's behalf. So I think that increases the vast disparity that exists when we have the state prosecuting these actions against the parent who's at a disadvantage, and it really becomes an unwholesomely unequal contest. You've got no one in the courtroom to represent the parent, and the state suggests, well, we've got the state still carries the burden by clear and convincing evidence, and we've got the guardian ad litem who's protecting the best interests, and I think in the GAL's brief, there was even a suggestion that the court would have an obligation to try to protect the fairness of the hearings. And I think that's really an unseemly position to put the court in, and it's sort of evident in this case in that Judge Simple at some point during the hearing had to jump in and say, well, I'm not sure that there's really enough here. And the court began asking questions. So I think that creates a problem for the courts.
Let me ask you about the statutory right. It's my understanding that the statute requires, I think it's 4823, requires that there be appointment of counsel. But the statute doesn't seem to go beyond that in terms of whether or not by a default counsel can no longer participate. So what is your argument directly in regard to the statute?
With regard to the statute, Justice Crooks, you're correct. It does not specifically address what occurs in a default situation. But as Justice Butler pointed out during the State's presentation, there's nothing in the default statutes that provides for the removal of counsel from the courtroom following a default. And I would submit that if this Court would find in this case that removal of counsel is required or is possible as a result of a default judgment, I don't see why that wouldn't be the case in every run-of-the-mill civil case. Why could a civil lawyer not be removed from a civil liability case following a default? So I think that this question, it does not just affect termination cases, but because civil procedure does govern these cases, this could have an impact on run-of-the-mill civil cases. And I think the civil bar would be very distraught to discover that their lawyers are going to be kicked out of the courtroom following a default judgment.
So you're tying your argument to, I think it's 804.12 and 805.03, is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
As
the
well
default
as
statutes.
Chapter 48.
The default statutes do not provide authority for removing a lawyer from the courtroom following a default. The court can impose specific sanctions, can prevent a party from perhaps presenting witnesses in some cases, and can render a default judgment, which this court says they cannot do in a TPR case prior to holding a fact-finding hearing. But there's no provision in the statutes for removing a lawyer from the courtroom. And I disagree with the State's position that not allowing the court to remove the lawyer from the courtroom somehow impacts the court's ability to sanction a parent through a default judgment. The court can certainly sanction through a default judgment, I think, and we've conceded that in this case based upon Evelyn C.R., that the court has the authority to do that. But I think the court removing the lawyer from the courtroom goes well beyond what the default statutes provide for.
When you say default statute, I think of 806, I think, is the default statute. Justice Crooks is referring to 805.03 and I think 804.12, which are the sanctions statutes.
Yes.
You seem to be basing your argument on the sanctions statute.
You're correct. I refer to them as the default statutes, but you're correct, Justice Bradley. It is the sanctions aspect. That's correct. The other thing that I'd like to touch upon is the State's position that the attorney cannot participate and that there's nothing that the attorney could do. And I disagree with that. At a minimum, I think the lawyer can cross-examine during the grounds hearing. And in this case, particularly, in most of these cases, the lawyer has already been provided with at least the paper discovery. There's a large number of documents that are involved from the Bureau's file, and in this case, the lawyer did have the discovery.
Counselor, do you think that there was sufficient evidence presented to support TPR based on a continuing CHIPS?
I do not. I do not think so.
And in regard to what efforts the county had made to reunify the mother and the child, is that of any concern to you?
It is of concern.
Why?
And I did raise that as in the insufficiency claims in my brief. We raised that in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals did not address the insufficiency claims. I think the reasonable efforts issue, there was not enough presented in the record from which the court could conclude that the Bureau had, in fact, made reasonable efforts to ensure that the parent was, that Shirley E. was, in fact, provided with services in order to complete her court conditions. I believe that the only testimony from the social worker was something to the effect of, well, Shirley E. has not contacted me to let me know whether she has stable housing or not. And there's no indication of what services were offered to her in order to ensure that she complete the court conditions. And there was also no, the order itself, the court order finding Torrance P. Jr. to be a child in need of protection services was, in fact, never entered into the record. So it's really unclear from the social worker's testimony, and you're not able to determine from the circuit court record what, in fact, the conditions were. The social worker did not testify to that. And I certainly think that that's something that a lawyer cross-examining the social worker could have explored in terms of specifically what efforts the Bureau made. That's certainly one aspect I think the lawyer could have covered if she had been allowed to stay.
It's my understanding that that the Court of Appeals ruled in your favor on the attorney ground.
On the right to counsel of justice, right. Yes.
That if this court affirms on that ground and agrees, it still has to deal with harmless error, which the Court of Appeals said where there's a lack of attorney, it's by definition harmless error.
Yes.
Okay.
Not harmless error.
No.
That's right. I'm sorry. It's not harmless. It is prejudicial error.
Yes.
If we disagree with the Court of Appeals on that ground, then both of you, I think, have briefed the issue of whether there's sufficiency of the evidence.
Yes.
Is that right? But we need not reach sufficiency of the evidence should we hold that there was prejudicial error.
Yes, I believe so. If the court finds in my favor and upholds the Court of Appeals decision, I don't believe the court has to reach sufficiency.
Well, counsel, let me follow up the Chief's question on that, because there's multiple ways of dealing with issues of harmless error, and one of them deals with whether or not there's overwhelming evidence, but court can find prejudicial, that the error is prejudicial on other bases as well. So I'm not sure that we still can avoid the sufficiency question.
That the error in depriving Shirley E of her right to counsel was prejudicial on other grounds?
I suggest that what Justice Butler is saying is that maybe it isn't structurally prejudicial.
Right.
That.
In other words, if we have to reach harmless error, we can find an error to be harmless on multiple levels, multiple different ways, or prejudicial on multiple. I'm not sure sufficiency in and of itself is the only thing. In fact, we've said that sufficiency is not the only thing that we look at. So I'm a little concerned about whether or not we still have to reach sufficiency.
Let me just make sure I understand your question. Are you suggesting that if the court would find that harmless error applies, but that in this case there's a reasonable possibility that lack of counsel affected the outcome, that the court would then still have to reach insufficiency?
Well, there's two different ways we could go. Let's say we say that the error here is prejudicial.
Okay.
All right. You win on the right to counsel issue. You still have sufficiency of the evidence claim that's of record. I would assume you'd want the court to reach that.
I think I understand your question. I've thought about this, and I'm not sure that the court has to reach it.
This is not a criminal case, so there's no double jeopardy here.
Exactly, and that's I guess that's what I've thought about in terms of the fact that it's not a criminal case. There's no double jeopardy protection for Shirley E., and so I'm not sure that the outcome
would... can bring this again.
Yes, that it could be brought in another petition again, so...
All right.
What are the consequences of holding in your favor? Let's say you have a no-good parent who doesn't show at things but has an attorney, a court-appointed attorney, and wants a jury trial. And so the court's concerned. Now, is the parent going to show up for this jury trial? I mean, I'm going to call in all these people in this county to sit on the jury, and then the person hasn't shown up for a few hearings, and what am I going to do? Well, the attorney says, judge, you know, she wants a jury trial. So the judge calls in the jurors, and the mother doesn't show, the attorney's there. Then I assume that you go through a full jury trial on the grounds. Is that right then?
You could.
Well, do you have any other alternative with that kind of scenario?
I think that's really the situation that occurred in Evelyn C.R. In that case, the mother requested a jury trial, and the court, upon finding her in default, and granted, the didn't follow the procedure there, but from that decision, I would take that the mother then waives her, in essence, waives her jury trial, right, or gives up her jury trial.
And Evelyn, the mother, wanted a jury trial. The court called a jury trial.
Yes.
The basis, I think, was abandoned.
Yes.
So the mother doesn't show up, which
doesn't
might be a prima facie case of
the grounds.
That's right. So the judge gets on the phone, finds the mother, and then they don't proceed with that jury trial. They release it. She still hasn't found her in default. They reschedule.
Right.
Yeah, so. But anyway, so what are the practical consequences? I mean, are we going to have then a proliferation because the attorney doesn't want to be held ineffective assistance of counsel? So, judge, yeah, we want our jury trial, so we have go through a jury trial without having the mother there. And then we get the verdict and find the grounds, and then we have the dispositional hearing. I mean, isn't that problematic?
I think that the court could allow a jury trial to go through. In fact, and I have talked to trial counsels who have, in fact, gone through jury trials without a client there. And it certainly makes it more difficult for the attorney, I think, with not being able to consult with the client. But I do think that the court may be able to find that by default, the parent has given up their jury and go ahead with a grounds hearing, a fact-finding hearing without the jury, pursuant to Evelyn C.R.
If you can find basis for a default, you know,
yes.
They just don't show
yes,
up.
Yes,
I mean, you need to find the egregious conduct.
Right, assuming the default is sound. And I think that at a minimum, the lawyers should be able to cross-examine, given the discovery that they've received in the case, should be able to adequately cross-examine the state's witnesses. They may have information. They may have witnesses to call on the client's behalf. And the state suggests in their brief that they will be at a disadvantage somehow of not being able to depose a parent who may be absent. And I would suggest that if the state's case solely relies upon having the testimony of the parent, that the grounds probably aren't that strong. They need to have other witnesses in order to be able to establish the grounds. And I think that the court could also address if there is any prejudice to the state by the parent's failure to appear in the proceeding or failure to appear at a deposition, the court can address that through the sanctions, through the court's ability to limit under Chapter 804 limit the scope of discovery and perhaps prevent the attorney from presenting some evidence or some witness if the state has been disadvantaged by its inability to depose the parent. But I don't see that as a real problem, and the court's removing the lawyer altogether from the courtroom just really seems extreme in terms of a sanction when the court has the ability to fashion more limited sanctions.
Could an appropriate sanction in this case have been to allow the attorney at the disposition hearing but prevent the attorney from presenting any evidence or participating?
Not at the disposition hearing, certainly not, because at the disposition hearing, I think under 48.427, the court is required to hear evidence from any party. And I also think when the court is under an obligation at the dispositional phase to consider the best interest of the child, I don't think it would be a good idea to prevent the court from hearing all available information. And I really think that's one of the significant problems with stripping a parent of their right to adversary counsel is it deprives the court of all the available information when the court is going to make this momentous decision of whether to terminate the relationship between the parent and the child. And we're not just talking about the parent here. This affects the child as well. The court has to make this agonizing decision, and I think all of the courts really want to do the right thing. They should want to have the most information available. They should welcome this information. So in terms of the dispositional phase, I think that an advocate for the counsel should not only be allowed to stay, but should be able to present any information they have that goes toward the disposition, including information that could be favorable to the parent regarding the prognosis for regaining custody of the child or efforts that they've made. I think that all of that should be presented, and it's in the court's best interest, it's in the parent's best interest, it's in the child's best interest. And I don't think it would really cost anything more to allow the attorney to stay. We've already got an attorney appointed. It's not as if we're talking about appointing an attorney in the first instance, as was discussed in Lassiter. The attorney's already in the courtroom, already appointed. They're familiar with the discovery. What cost does it really take to allow the lawyer to stay and cross-examine and perhaps put forth some defense on behalf of the client?
How is this case going to play out if you prevail in this court?
In terms of in the future in circuit court cases? If I prevail on the right to counsel issue, I would expect that it would be remanded to the circuit court for further hearings, including a redo of the evidentiary hearing where Shirley E. would have counsel.
So would you move to reopen the default judgment?
If I were the trial lawyer, yes, I would.
And do you think, how long do you think that would take?
To get it remanded and bring the motion? Well, I know that the circuit court takes these cases very seriously. There are timelines, et cetera. I would expect that in terms of bringing the motion to default, once the case would be remitted back, it would not take very long for the court to schedule that. But in terms of how long, you know, it would play out in terms of the contest and the disposition, I would think a matter of months. But I'm sure that it would be primary on the court's calendar.
Counselor, have you been communicating with your client during the course of these appellate proceedings?
I have.
Thank you.
She still resides in Michigan.
Thank you.
One other issue that I wanted to touch on is this idea of waiver. The state indicates that it believes that Shirley E. may have waived her right to counsel under the statute, and I would submit, first of all, the state conceded in their brief in chief at page 26, that there is, in fact, no knowing and voluntary waiver here. And under the statute and the case law, I think it's clear there's no knowing and voluntary waiver. There's certainly nothing on the record. And the fact that she failed to appear simply cannot be construed as a knowing and voluntary waiver. I think we may be confusing waiver versus forfeiture. In terms of forfeiture, I don't think that we can find that Shirley E.'s conduct in not traveling from Michigan to the hearing in Wisconsin either had the purpose or the effect of frustrating the orderly progression of the case through the circuit court. So I think under State versus Coleman, there's no indication that forfeiture would be applicable here.
There's no knowing and voluntary waiver of counsel here. How was there a knowing and voluntary waiver of a jury trial in the Evelyn C.R. case?
That's a good question. And to be honest, I have not had the opportunity to extrapolate that out. As I indicated before, I think the court could allow a jury trial to go through, and I do, in fact, know of situations where a court has allowed counsel to continue through a jury trial subsequent to finding someone in default. But my reading of Evelyn C.R. was that this court found that that was appropriate, that the court's procedure there in having testimony, albeit after the default finding, was sufficient and did not indicate, the opinion does not indicate to me that this court had an issue with the Tequila's demand for a jury trial being in effect waived. She was certainly not given a jury trial in that case, and this court upheld the circuit court's decision. But I don't have a specific answer for that question. And again, I do know of cases
maybe
where this happened.
Maybe that was forfeiture.
Forfeiture of the right to jury trial?
Yeah, if you don't show up.
Perhaps, yes. Any more questions? Because I see my time is up.
No, your timing is perfect, counsel. Ms. Kiefer?
There are just a few points I'd like to address on rebuttal. First, the state maintains that there's not only sufficient evidence to support the grounds that the court found, as well as the best interests of this child, that the termination of parental rights petition be granted. But there's ample evidence to support the findings of the trial court. The trial court did have the CHIPS dispositional extension order before it. It's within the record in two places. Moreover, there was testimony provided to the court that Shirley E. had not been consistently available to utilize services due to her living out of the county. There was evidence before the court that she completed some alcohol and other drug abuse programming while she was incarcerated for a period of time. There was there was evidence about her prior visitation schedule with Torrance in the underlying case, as well as evidence before the court that Shirley E. had not seen the child since December of 2003.
Ms. Kiefer, let me ask you this. What about Ms. Cornwall's point that she made during her argument that in dealing at the dispositional phase where, of course, the best interest of the child is at stake, it's to everyone's advantage, the courts, the child's, and all of the parties, to get as much information as possible at that proceeding so that the trial court can make the correct decision for the child. When I hear that, it seems to make logical sense that even if the parent is not there, if you have an attorney that has information or can bring out information through the cross-examination process or through presenting evidence, if there's evidence to present, that aids the court in its dispositional function, and it makes sure that the right thing happens for that child. That argument seems to make some sense. What's your response to that?
It does make sense, but that's not this case. The attorney in this case was not aided by a deposition transcript of her client's testimony. The record in this case fully supports that counsel for Shirley E. was not in touch with her on a regular basis.
But the attorney can still cross-examine and get information before the court in that process. And from the standpoint of making sure that the judge has all the information possible, what's wrong with making sure that all of that comes out during the procedure?
When a party is in default, as Shirley E. was in this point in time, the sanction statutes, 804.12 sub 2 sub A, specifically point 2 of that, provides that the court may enter an order refusing the disobedient party to support or oppose any designated claims or defenses. What you're suggesting, allowing an attorney for a person who's in default to cross-examine witnesses that the state's putting forth, while that person is still in default, is contrary to the sanctioned statutes for default.
Let's assume that that's correct. For purposes of my question, I don't think you've answered the question. The question is, if the goal of the trial court is to make sure that the best interests of the child are taken into account and protected, what is pragmatically wrong with getting as much information as possible at that proceeding through any source available?
There's nothing wrong with that. But I would submit to the court that allowing an attorney who is unaided by their client and who does not have the participation of their client, merely cross-examining witnesses, does not aid the court in any fact-finding matter. I know that on Ms. Cornwall's presentation to the court, she talked about my brief's point about the discovery issue. We're talking about supplying information to the court and providing the best evidence to the court. And I would like to know for the court that it was Shirley E. herself who withheld the information from the trial court by not participating in this matter. She could have come to court. She could have called the court at any point in time. She could have made herself available for depositions by phone if she was, in fact, in the state of Michigan. And she didn't do so. And the state's case does not rely solely on a parent's testimony, but most times parents are the best evidence that we have at these termination of parental rights proceedings. Aside from the child, they're usually the only other firsthand witness to what occurred when the child was an infant, 1 or 2 years old. We can't put the child on the stand to testify about what happened then. The parent is the person that the state usually uses and in that facet to find those facts before the trial court. We have the record of the Bureau of Milwaukee Child Welfare as well to aid us in the fact-finding hearing, but the parent participating is always the best way to arrive at a good factual determination. Allowing counsel to participate would not further that, but having a parent participate would.
Thank you, Ms. Kiefer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cornwall, for a termination parental rights argument. As several of the justices have noted, these are very difficult cases because young people have their childhood escaping while we all debate legal issues. That concludes the hearing on 05-AP-2752, State versus Shirley E. The court will take a recess for a few moments so that if anybody wishes to leave the courtroom, he or she may, and there are other students waiting to come in.